Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, July 31st, 1998, and the Creekside room this morning is Mary Boys. Today's session number is 98-8, and it is titled Renewing Our Worship. Let's listen in.
And this is the final session that I will be doing in these 2 weeks as I begin the journey home tomorrow by way of a few days in Spokane before I head to the iniquity of New York City. And I've been very pleased to do these sessions, but they've been a little challenging to me because this is not my primary field. This is a project I've been working on for a long time. As sort of an avocation and obviously as a passion. And I consider this particular session very important because I have to say that for me, the church's worship, the liturgy, has been and remains enormously formative. When I think how it is I learned to be a Christian, I think that the taproot of that is my experience of the church's worship, which as in many respects, sometimes left things to be desired. I'm not saying that I have always had the mountaintop experiences, but I mean as a kind of a regular basis. And coming as I do as a Catholic from the liturgical church and teaching as I do now at an ecumenical school, graduate school of theology, once a Presbyterian seminary in its origins that became a non-denominational liberal Protestant seminary, and now, God forbid, in the late 1990s, the Lutherans are the number one grouping. There are only two Presbyterians on the faculty right now, which means the Union forebearers are turning in their graves. And there are five Lutherans and four Catholics. So you see that really the heresy is about to come, or again, maybe. Save your money, don't go to the movie. Seeing the previews, why go to the film? But at any rate, but I realized that something like the liturgical year is a template in my bone marrow. And while I work with people from many different traditions, including those for whom the liturgical year doesn't make sense or it's not in them, I can only respect their point of view, but it seems so foreign to me. And forgive me if today I spend some time on how we celebrate during the liturgical year, because it is so formative for me, and I think for people, particularly for Lutherans, this is a similar kind of template. I'd like to begin first with a prologue, raise some issues about the church's liturgy, and end with some orientations. I have tried in planning this today have this be a little briefer, because some of you have been to more than one session this week, which qualifies you for the award for masochism or something like that. But I really haven't had enough time, I haven't given enough time for discussion, and I'm aiming to end my own comments by 10 or 15 after, so that we can have some good time for discussion. And if you don't have anything to say, unlikely though I think that is, well, we'll call it God's grace and end. Before I begin, though, I just wanted to point out I had a conversation with somebody at breakfast about computer technology. I was laughing about the fact that I sometimes get this message on my computer: your program has performed an illegal operation,
yes,
and will be shut down. What? The police are after me? I say to my computer, I have not.
Yes, I know.
But it shuts down. But for those of you who do enjoy working with your computer, there are a couple of websites that might help you to explore some of the issues that have come up in the course of this week. So I put the two of the websites here. One is jcrelations.com. The other, I believe this is right, is icjs.com. And on the ICJS one, I have an annotated bibliography, I haven't updated it for about a year now. But there are many other things. There are various papers. There are links to other websites. These are the only two I really remembered. But both of these have links to other websites And I've also put my own email address in case you think of examples or your questions or whatever. I'm a little better at answering email than I am what they call snail mail. Mostly because it's easier. So I don't promise an instant response. So let me begin then with the prologue. As not only one blessing. Some time ago, I was rereading the story in Genesis of Jacob and Esau. And as you recall, from the very beginning, the two twins are contending in Rebekah's womb, and that contention lasts through the duration of their lives. And I really wasn't looking for this in the text. It sort of came to me as I was rereading. I don't exactly remember what it was that led me to rereading this. And I was struck with the poignancy in chapter 27 of Esau's experience when he realizes that Jacob has supplanted him by receiving his father's blessing. A supplanting that must have been all the more difficult to take, given the collusion of Rebekah in the whole thing. But toward the end of chapter 27, after Isaac has already given his blessing to Jacob, Esau says, this is verse 38, "Have you only one blessing, Father? Bless me also, Father." And Esau lifted up his voice and wept. And I guess because I have been thinking about the relationship we Christians have with Jews, it struck me that one of our issues as Christians is that sometimes we have such a limited notion of God, and that God only has one blessing to give. And if God gave the blessing first to the Jewish people, but now God's blessing is upon us, then the blessing must somehow have disappeared from the Jews. I don't mean to say people think this as as an explicit thought, but I suspect at some level, maybe it's the sibling rivalry still left within us. I know when my mother and her sisters were all in their 80s, they were still arguing a bit about who had loved them the most. "Oh, you were Dad's favorite," they'd say. I'd say, "Geez, at 86, does it matter anymore?" And I guess it must somehow, you know. I mean, I don't mean they were enemies, but it did sort of amuse me when I would hear them talking. And recently I did a 3-year project with a group of Jewish and Christian educators in which we met together for live-in sessions and studied together and so forth. And that's written up in the best-selling thriller, Jewish-Christian Dialogue. I say these things because my mother has said to me on more than one occasion, "Why don't you write something interesting?" And she wasn't teasing. She wouldn't have found this interesting either. But I would. And at the conclusion of this colloquium, we wrote up edited a journal, on the experience. And one of the articles that was written by two rabbis, a Reformed rabbi and an Orthodox rabbi writing together, which is in itself, you know, some of the divisions within Judaism, represents a sort of miracle. But at any rate, they have this wonderful paragraph about God's relationship between Jews and Christians. And let me just read through this one paragraph. "The problem is not in God, but in our own failure to understand that God loves different people equally. Learning how to be mature and healthy siblings celebrates the unique ways in which love is bestowed from above. Perhaps, as in Genesis, this new understanding can only come after sibling rivalries degenerate into fratricide, exclusion, or abandonment. But after the Shoah, after the Holocaust, are we not ready to reconceive our idea of a broader family through a more loving paradigm? And can we afford not to?" And so I just posed this question at the beginning. Can we in our world today afford not to think that God, who is beyond all names and beyond all our imagining, might have more than one blessing to bestow? And might, when God blesses a people, might that blessing not endure and not be removed because another piece of people is also blessed with God. So I leave that. Obviously, I think you know what my response is, but my response need not be 10 years. So just a word then about the church's worship, to use the word liturgy here, by which I mean a fairly common understanding here, the public, the communal, and ritual worship of the church. I will also mention occasionally private devotions, but my focus today is really on the way the church worships. And I realize that it's very difficult to adequately generalize about the way the church worships, because one of the divisions in Christianity is that we do worship differently. Although, at least in my experience, in terms, say, of like Catholic, Lutheran, and Episcopal, you have to be pretty aware, if you go to a Eucharist, to know just what the differences are. I mean, they're quite subtle differences. I remember one time being at an Episcopal Eucharist, it was a chapel where both Catholics and Episcopalians shared worship, and I was there about 20 minutes before I realized it happened to be Episcopal, only because it was higher church than I was used to. I think that even though, I probably am not talking about the way something like Christians who are Assembly of God or Unitarian Universalist, sort of on the other end of the spectrum, I'm probably talking less directly about their worship life than I am about so-called mainline Protestant churches and Catholic Church. I'm not saying much about what happens in the Orthodox churches because it's so different, and because my experiential base is different. I really have not had as much experience there. And I would just like to raise questions, and many of you have been to some of these sessions, so I think you can guess at some of them, about what it is, what's the impact during our great season. I know I have this backwards in terms of liturgical. I mean, I realize that. But the first shall be last and all that. So I simply would like to raise a question of what happens in terms of what people hear in congregations about Judaism that is very subtle. I am not talking about any explicitly anti-Semitic teaching, or even really about any explicitly or deliberate anti-Jewish preaching or commentary. What I'm talking about, what it is, if you go to church on a regular basis, Sunday after Sunday, what it is the average person, if the average person exists, but I'm not talking about people who are theologically literate here, I'm talking about people who go to church with goodwill and who are as attentive as they know how, and who don't, you know, spend a lot of time studying and thinking, what it is that they hear about our relationship to Jews and Judaism. And so I thought it might help us to just take a little sampling of what it is you might hear say during Lent. And I would be more than happy to have people, particularly people here who are pastors, remind me of things that I might in this very quick survey overlook. And I'm presuming that for the most part, the lectionary, when I talk about the lectionary, the texts are shared texts. There is some difference in the Revised Common Lectionary and the Roman Lectionary, but the differences are fairly minimal. So let us begin with Ash Wednesday. I'm always amazed with Ash Wednesday, at least in the Catholic tradition. We have a joke about how many more people seem to come on Ash Wednesday than come really on Easter Sunday for whatever reason. It's because they get something. You know, they get ashes, and then on Palm Sunday they get palms. But I don't think it's just that. I don't mean to make fun of it in any way, because what really, I think I'm very edified. I think that there is in the Christian people as a whole a real desire to repent. I think we're pretty in touch with the fact that we can get strayed pretty far from God's ways at times, or just simply become kind of unconscious. And Ash Wednesday, I think, is sort of that determination to change our lives. I really believe that people come with that. I usually do. I also find by the end of the 6 weeks that some of the determination sort of melted along the way, you know. But at any rate, and of course the gospel reading, which is very powerful from Matthew, talks about the hypocrites in the synagogue, and it's a wonderful text, of course, you know. When you pray, don't blow the trumpet before you, and when you fast, for God's sakes, comb your hair, which is the hairdresser's passage. And if you run a beauty salon, that's the feature. But again, I don't think that this is the time to do a lot of preaching on the relationship between Jews and Christians, but what I'm suggesting is that you start with a sense that the people in the synagogue are hypocrites. And you also, if you read Matthew, you can read text back and forth and to know that this seems to be said about the Pharisees. So, and of course, what happens with us is the Pharisees stand for what is wrong with Judaism, that they're legalistic. And that was the very first session that I did in this. This was a week ago, Monday, so none of you happen to have been there for that, and you're probably your whole life you will miss that. But the Pharisees were not legalists, historically speaking, but the description of the Pharisees and the characterization of them as legalistic hypocrites really comes on the later period when the church is tending with what seems to be the leadership group that survived the fall of Jerusalem in 70. But one of the things that happens is hypocrites equal Pharisees, Pharisees equal legalists, legalists equal Jews, work righteous people. And I think that subtly that those kinds of connections happen. Let me give you another example how subtle those connections can be. Again, I don't think people think about this explicitly. When I first moved to the East Coast and people would ask me where I was from, I would say Washington. Well, on the East Coast, there's only one Washington. It happens to be the District of Columbia. So I soon learned to say Seattle or the state of Washington. Okay? So that would happen, say, early in the evening, people would say, where are you from, and so forth. And usually I got one of two responses. Oh, it must be so cold out there, you know, if you're close to Alaska. And I always said, well, we had some ice igloos in our family, and we were able to. We also had indoor toilets now. Things were advancing civilization-wise. But the more frequent remembrance is because I said I was from the Northwest, that was immediately translated West Coast, and West Coast equals California. God forbid I should be confused with California. But that happened to me so many times, and I see what they don't know very much. You know, real Easterners know that the center of the universe is usually Boston. Yeah. Even New Yorkers are pretty cosmopolitan, but Bostonians know where the center of the world is. The hub of the universe is right there in Boston. And if you weren't born there, you really don't count. And of course, I spoke like a Galilean anyway. And I said R's where they were, and I went to church, and I didn't say la, not lassie. It's really true. So what I'm trying to get at are those subtle associations we have, the way the mind works, and even if the teaching isn't explicit. And then to think, I'm going to talk about hymnody. Latin hymnody doesn't strike me as too problematic, unless you do things like sing the reproaches and so forth. But what I would like to do is to move quite quickly toward the end of Lent, Palm Sunday or Passion Sunday, when on the three-year cycle, one of the Passion accounts is read from the Gospels of Mark, Matthew, and Luke. And then to point ahead to Good Friday, when in many of the churches, the Passion account from the Gospel of John is read. In all of the Passion accounts, it's quite clear, if you listen carefully, that whatever responsibility the Romans had for the death of Jesus is not at all emphasized. Pontius Pilate, who was historically a fairly venal and violent man, in fact, so violent that ultimately Rome removed him from office, is portrayed not really as an evil man in the scriptures, but he is portrayed as a weak man. And the people who are agitating for the crucifixion are variously the Jewish leaders, and sort of generalized, not sort of made specific, or, in the case by the time you get to John's Gospel, the Jews as a whole. And in each of the four Passion accounts, there are particular problems. Now, I don't think that Good Friday is the time necessarily to preach on all of this. At least the liturgy is very full of other things. But what I'm suggesting is, again, people take this in. And if you listen to the Passion accounts, if you read them on your own, all the more so, you can't help but conclude, unless you have knowledge to the contrary, that the Jews are responsible for the death of Jesus. And those of you who were here yesterday know how this charge got taken up in the charge of deicide in the church and so forth. So just a little word about Lent. Now we make it through Lent, we make it through Good Friday, And then after Easter seems to me to be some of the other liturgical problems in the text, because at least one of the things that happens in the Roman Catholic lectionary, and I think this happens in the Revised Common Lectionary, but I would be happily corrected. I've left all my books at home, and I'm trying to prepare classes, you know, I can see this book on my shelf, and if I could just look up this fact, it would be exact. But, so get your money back later on this afternoon. The reading from the Old Testament, or the Hebrew Bible, is replaced by the reading from Acts of the Apostles. Is that right?
Yes.
And particularly in the early Sundays after Easter, you have these speeches of Peter, which are sort of the core of Christianity, and begin something like, "This Jesus whom you killed." So even if you didn't pick it up in the Passion account, it's even clearer and bolder and balder, as it were, after Easter. And then juxtapose that to the fact that we Christians love to sing these great hymns of triumph after Easter. So again, I'm not talking so much the explicit stuff as I am what people take away. Christianity has triumphed. Christ's death has settled. Christ's death and resurrection has conquered evil. And somehow the Jews are still implicated in that evil. Now, I'm proceeding, as you can see, extremely rapidly, backwards though it is, through the liturgical year. But I wanted to say a word about Advent, because in many ways, I think this might even be more problematic than the other two. And maybe it's because, personally speaking, I find Advent the most beautiful liturgical season. I don't know what it is. It's not because I'm sentimental so much about Christmas, it's just because it seems to me we touch something very deep, this longing for the world to be different, and this sense of waiting and expectations and so forth. And those of you who've been to Bible study know the importance of this term, watch. And on those first Sundays of Advent, that's the key word, watch, stay awake. Now, if you could just daydream for a minute, in case you weren't already, justify this. What do you sing in Advent?
O come Emmanuel.
O come Emmanuel. Someone want to start that?
Well, really, people outside, they really thought they would have lost it.
O come Emmanuel, and ransom captive Israel, that mourns in lonely exile here, until all Son of God appear. Rejoice, rejoice, Emmanuel shall come to you, O Israel.
Do you hear what we just sang? Now, I find that haunted, beautiful hymn. I can't sing it anymore. Now, I did not bring with me Barbara Lundblad, Pastor Barbara Lundblad, who's now the professor of homiletics at Union, has done new lyrics to this that I can sing. I haven't actually gotten them in my into our own parishes. This isn't so like terribly, this isn't an anti-Semitic hymn, but it suggests that somehow Israel is still lying in wait, captive, and what, and it's sort of all the more ironical because there's actually a modern state of Israel which is contending with very real difficult issues today. But it's this sense. And then one of the other things that happens is that I have yet to live through an Advent, because I travel a lot on weekends, I go to a fair number of different usually Catholic congregations, and I've yet to make it to a Lent in which I haven't heard somebody mention in the homily that we are preparing for the coming of Jesus as the Messiah, and Jesus is the suffering Messiah, and the reason that the Jewish people didn't recognize him is that they were waiting for a royal, glorious, or kingly Messiah, something like that. Does that have the ring of familiarity that you've heard somewhere? And I always want to stand up and say, excuse me, but you have, I often want to stand up and say, excuse me, but you have just grossly oversimplified what messianic expectation was among Jews. That it was there was no single script for who the Messiah would be. And it's not a simple matter of just finding a few texts in Micah or whatever, or Isaiah, and sort of proof texting and say, aha, that's Jesus, and if they only wouldn't have been so dense, and if they only could have read their own scriptures more adequately, they would have heard, seen the prophets. By the way, it's very interesting how this actually happens all during these seasons, and maybe particularly during Lent, but to some extent during Advent, although during Advent we tend to use a lot of Isaiah texts almost as if they're specific foretellings of Jesus, as if sort of Isaiah has Jesus in mind when whoever Isaiah was, if you have this notion of the fact that there might be three collections of Isaiah that were put together finally. So we tend to read the kind of the Emmanuel, so-called Emmanuel prophecies and so forth. But if you think, when the church reads the critique of the prophets, say, about the way worship is disconnected from justice, we sometimes make it, I've heard it preached in this way, that the Jews didn't listen to their prophets, as if somehow we Christians listen to ours. And I think it's true. Israel didn't listen to its prophets. I think it's equally true. We don't listen to them. But sort of the nature of that kind of classical prophecy is that it's such a challenge that we, as Isaiah says, the people say, preach to us smooth things. And I think if you're a pastor, gee, that would be a great temptation to preach smooth things because the collection's better. You know, people don't come out and say, oh, pastor, that, I don't know how you could say it, you know, that kind of thing. So in Advent, we set up this notion that the Jews missed the train, they missed who the Messiah was, and we have the Messiah. And one of the other things that happens with Advent, it seems to me, especially toward the end, when all of a sudden we collapse Advent with Christmas. About halfway through Advent, it seems to me, the church kind of gets in Christmas tree mode. That is to say, the sense of longing for the completion of God's reign among us, the sense of thy kingdom come, which is so powerful in the early days of Advent, somehow gets confused with the Christ child who came in history, and tends to get a little sentimental, and we lose this sense of attentiveness to the God who is still being revealed, and yet to be revealed in fullness. Now let me stop here because I'm hoping that I'm reminding you of some things that happened in your own congregations or some misgivings that you might have even about what I've said or how we as a church sort of subtly undermine Judaism by the way we interpret texts, by our hymnody, to a certain extent by our bodily postures or gestures or whatever. That's perhaps more subtle. So let me invite Congress. Yes.
Well, I think you're absolutely right about the triumphant hymns during Easter, but to me it's always tempered by the cyclical nature of the lectionary and the seasons. And the sad thing is that you get people who come at Easter and they don't come again until Christmas. So what they know are poinsettias and lilies.
That's right.
And you know, and you as a pastor, I need to be grateful that those people come at that time. But I'm always sad that they don't come on a regular basis to know that it's a cyclical thing, and it's not just a triumphant Christ is risen, but surely we want to proclaim that.
And
but only after the Lenten, you know, the journey there, and then again the teaching season of Pentecost, I hope I can hear the new lyrics to Come Emmanuel. The other part of it is that in my growing up and in my preparation for pastoring, I don't remember. To me, Israel and the hypocrites always are me and us, not so much the Jews. But you know, I do know the conversation about being careful about those Acts texts. The problem with some of the Acts texts during Easter is that they're severely cut.
Yes.
So that you only hear that part about you killed Jesus. You don't hear the part that leads up to that.
And at least in my experience, the texts from Acts usually aren't preached on, usually the Gospels preached
yes.
on. So again, you just floated texts to people and they've heard it. And at some level, I think they're taken in. And what I'm really concerned about is sort of the implicit
yes.
level at which we hear things.
Probably the hymns are what are the biggest source of the unconscious absorption of Advent. you know, it's easier to brainwash somebody if they don't know that they're brainwashed. And so I think the text of the hymns are extremely, we have to be very close to that.
Yes.
Let me
say, I think that what you say is right, but I would agree on the hymn point. But I think that the lectionary itself now, and you know, getting to know the Revised Common Lectionary, which has some shifts from our old Lutheran lectionary, has resources within it to, in fact, counteract, you know, I mean, with I know in our clergy text study group, we have several people that are really tuned in on this issue, and so in our own study of the text and how the lectionary is set up, I think there are some tools that counteract this. I mean, for example, in Lent, the Revised Common Lectionary has shifted us much more to a focus on baptism and really compressing the sort of, you know, journey to the cross to like the last, you know, last week or two, which makes it much more, you know, not so much on, you know, the Pharisees trying to trap Jesus in that building plot, but, you know, more on ourselves and the church. Also something I think I said yesterday was that the language itself in the scripture language, and looking at, you know, those passion narratives and how, you know, and there are other translations that look at that, you know, like in John's gospel, that look at the word Jew, which is used in about, you know, six different ways, the right. Same word Jew used in John's gospel, and instead substituting, you know, Judeans or the religious authorities, yeah, or where appropriate. And frankly, I feel real free to use that. I used to change those words myself, but now I've found a translation that I like. And I think that's really important. I mean, that's where there still are problems. But I think, I guess my basic point is, I think the lectionary can also help us back off from that, you know, that kind of simplicity.
Well, I think the crucial thing is, once you have sensitivity to this,
yeah,
I don't think the lectionary is a big problem, because I think you bring your own eyes,
you know,
your own sensitivity to it. And the same thing to a certain extent with hymnody. I think, you know, how what we sing is very important. Of course, the words of prayer are also important, although sometimes when it gets too wordy, people tend to... I said I would mention a couple of different devotions, so this being an equal opportunity critique, let me give two examples before we move on. What is pastoral commentary on text? I always try to pay attention to what are the things that people in the church have access to, not the things that scholars write for the most part, which are usually written in another language, that looks like English but doesn't read like English. But, you know, so in the Catholic tradition, there's a little publication that comes out of Ottawa, both in English and in French, called Living with Christ, and it has the daily. It's a very cheap, very, you know, cheap paper, you know, I didn't bring it with me, that has all of the lectionary texts, both daily and Sunday, for a month. You subscribe, you know, for a year or whatever. And I know thousands of people, millions of people who use it. Well, I might be prone to exaggeration, but it would be the kind of... And on Sundays, they have different people who write commentaries, just a very brief, it's like three paragraphs, on the Sunday readings. And they're lay people in the churches all through Canada, since it's a Canadian publication. And so this Lent, on the fifth Sunday, I just opened my copy of the text just to see what the readings were for that Sunday. And here's the commentary. I forget what the exact reference is, but it doesn't matter. Quote, "What was it in the soul of a scribe or a Pharisee that seemed to shut out the possibility of compassion for fellow human beings in favor of the security and social status of upholding the law?" Now, what I'm saying is that the average person, you know, picks up and wants to have a little sense of what this reading might be about, sort of a kind of a basic concept to come to the text with. They're already distorted. This commentary has already distorted the text. Now, about the same time, actually this was a little earlier, I was standing at the Xerox machine at Uni, where I spent a lot of time standing and cursing and asking first for God's blessing on this machine and then wishing I mentioned that Pastor Lundblad, Barbara Lundblad, she was steaming. And she had in her hand a devotional called For All the Saints, a prayer book for and by the church. And it was a daily devotional done by the Metropolitan New York Synod of the ELCA for this Lent. And here's one of the prayers for the beginning of Lent. Or I don't know if this is exactly a prayer, it's kind of a commentary. Only the church offers the Creator this pure oblation. Oh, by the way, I should say, this is a quote from Irenaeus, the Bishop of Lyon, second century. Only the church offers the Creator this pure oblation, offering him, with thanksgiving, things that are part of his creation. The Jews no longer offer, for their hands are full of blood. They did not accept the word through whom an offering can be made to God. Yeah, well, it's in New York City. I told you it was the den of iniquity. But,
when was that?
1998.
Is there an offer on it?
Yeah, there is, but I'm not protecting.
For All the Saints is a four-volume set produced by American Lutheran Publishing here. Oh, it's not the Metro Center.
Well, this particular one,
I see.
Couldn't leave it to me to, you know. Now, again, I'm not trying to go after the Lutherans or the Catholics or whatever. What I'm trying to say is that even if you're the pastor and you have sensitive ears and eyes, until we get to the people who write the pastoral commentaries, still people are, we can understand what was happening in the second and third century church that would lead Irenaeus to make a comment like that. But to cite it, and believe me, there's no context given in the devotional that helps one to understand this. It just sort of floats there. Yes?
And just to put this all in a certain Holocaust context, because that's what I do, I have to point out,
speak to everybody,
I have to point out the obvious, and that is that this kind of thing is not lost on Jewish theologians. This kind of thing is not lost on rabbis. And so when we meet together at academic conferences, these kinds of things are still pointed out as being substantial reasons why what Christians ultimately need to be doing is keeping their, the very famous quote, keep your hands off me and my children. And as long as that kind of thing remains at the level of devotionals, our work, academics, is going to be extremely difficult. It's going to continue to be difficult in establishing trustworthy Jewish-Christian dialogue, at least in terms of a Holocaust context. I would love to see that sort of thing be eradicated. It makes our work extremely difficult. And the problem is, and this is a question that I have, as an academic, I don't know how to eradicate it. How do we create that kind of dialogue that makes this sort of thing unthinkable?
Well, I mean, I think one way to do that is that we do more things collectively so that, I mean, when we do text study, you know, some people are just a lot more tuned in on this because of their personal experience in study. And so, you know, we correct each other, you know, and I think, and given our, you know, how much we've been shaped by all this, I think, to me, it speaks for, you know, doing much more of our theological thinking and preparation of resources in a collective manner so that things like this don't, you know, get out.
I don't think you can do it. There's no easy answer, just like a lot of problems like this. There's no easy answer, but it's little by little. So I agree with you. And it's the awareness. You know, it's in the great scheme of things, time, and I don't mean to say that time heals all ills, but, you know, this is a relatively new thing for a lot of us as Christians, and I think it takes time to filter down, even to pastors like me, and hopefully to people. So I think we just have to keep plugging away. I don't think there's any, you know, tomorrow it's going to be because we do this, but I think you have to continue your work, and you do. And hopefully we have to try to do it together.
Yeah, and the thing that I would like to see happen would be the kind of dialogue that's happening here, where mm-hmm. academics and people who are pastors and other people can actually kind of cross-fertilize, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
but in Christmas, it seems it's not only the matter we are singing with our prayers and so on, but also the attitude of priests and pastors from the pulpit. They are always immediately on the side of God, or they are always immediately on the side of Jesus. When Jesus has an argument with a Jewish group, they know the exit already. And they don't take the argument of the enemies of this group seriously. And I think that's and they have Jewish, in these arguments with Jesus, they are serious causes. There are serious arguments. For example, give us a sign. And since it's a real argument to ask for a sign if you see poor people longing for sign, but the Christian pastors immediately know to ask for sign is the sin or is wrong and so on. And I think this kind of inner attitude to be always and immediately on the right side, since it's the source of anti-Judaism.
And that's why I think one of the things that's key in Bible study of any kind is to help people learn to identify with all the characters in the text, but particularly the characters in the text who don't get it. For instance, I was just thinking about two passages that the lectionary juxtaposes. Exodus 17, when the Israelites are out there groaning in the wilderness because they don't have water, and then the woman from Samaria in chapter 4 of John's Gospel. And sort of one way to preach about it is to say, well, you know, the Israelites groaned and they didn't understand God as a source of water and so forth, whereas this woman from Samaria really gets it and she comes to worship and she becomes the evangelist to Samaria. And so we sort of identify with this woman. And particularly maybe now that, you know, we women have discovered that we actually make it in the scriptures a little bit, it's all the more temptation to identify with this great woman who, after all, is as an apostle to Samaria. And you know, who knows historically, you know, even though you can't verify this, but given the fact that it might be unlikely that Samaritans joined this group of believers in Jesus, given the animosities that existed, who knows to what extent there might be a memory in John's church, John's community, that indeed a woman had been responsible for the coming of this group to believing in Jesus. But all that being said, but when we read Exodus, might we not identify? I know where I'd be. I'd be out there leading the grumbling. No, I mean, Exodus is so fabulous. They just get across the Red Sea and they're already bitching and moaning because the food isn't like it was in Egypt. And you know, we're the Israelites here. But it's just so easy to, you know, somehow, we're on Jesus' side. We would have gotten it. Even though, actually, the Gospels in some ways were, you know, in Mark's Gospel, which I find so delightful to read in many respects, despite its brevity, is that the disciples are the last to get it. You know, Jesus works this, you know, great miracle, and they're still, you know, dumbfounded, and along comes the blind person who sees. You know, it's almost always a sort of comparison contrast, and they come out pretty poorly. So how it is in our preaching we can help people to identify, you know, with all, the Pharisee and the publican in Luke. And, you know, we kind of identify with the publican's prayer. Well, probably our prayer is a little more like the Pharisees, particularly those of us who might take the beautiful days of the sort of the middle to the end of the summer and go to Holden Village where you do things like go to talks and Bible study and Vespers at night. Jim Sanders, who's a Dead Sea Scroll scholar, and a Presbyterian minister, it's kind of an old line by now, I've heard him use it very often, but he loves to sort of slip as if it's a misstep when he's talking about the Pharisees and talk about Presbyterians. But really, the Pharisees are actually, the people who come to Holden Village are more like the Pharisees than any other group of first century Judaism. And we are meant to, and that what the Pharisees at the symbolic level represent is religiosity gone awry. Well, let me wind up and then give the rest of the time to, because I wanted to end on a note of hope here. Because I actually think that there is a great deal. The relationship between our two communities, while there's enormous work still to be done, I cannot believe the sea change in most Christian churches. The Southern Baptists, which are the largest Protestant denomination, are the one exception. In 1996, they passed a resolution at their convention to proselytize Jews. But other disciples of Christ, Lutherans, at least the ALCA, Presbyterians, Catholics, Methodists, those are groups that come to mind most readily, statements from the World Council of Churches. The documents are so radically different and scarcely imaginable that these documents belong to the same churches that interact with the Jews, or the same Christian body that interacted with the Jews for the nearly 2,000 years previous. I want to suggest three orientations in our liturgical life that might help us. And I tried to put these in a very shorthand way. I thought I might draw on Bob for the first one. And just as a little background to this, sometimes when we speak about God in the churches, we use cheap grace, kind of glibness about God solving all. And, you know, divine providence is always with us in some sort of way that's recognizable. And all this talk about what's God's will that this happens, and so, which I think consider to be very, very dangerous speech. And after the Shoah, after the Holocaust, it seems to me, we have to recognize that there have been radical disruptions in history. And that God's plan, which is another metaphor that I think is not at all helpful, is not something we can readily discern. And that our liturgical life should include as much lament, I mean, it, no, maybe not as much lament, I don't mean this in a literal sense, but that we have a lot to cry out to God about. That you know, yes, I don't think in any way that our proclamation of the resurrection of Jesus is made less powerful by our recognition that the work of the resurrection has not yet been accomplished. That God's reign is not here, and that there is much we do not understand about God. We are always, so that we are always in a way silenced by what we don't understand. And I personally find the greatest help for that in the Psalter, the full Psalter, not the kind of expurgated version we often use where we use the strophes about praise and gratitude and whatever, and we sort of pass over the sense of enmity and abandonment of God. You know, awake God, why are you sleeping? Which is, I think, a great thing to say at the 6 in the morning or something, that isn't God is sleeping, but at any rate. So the sense that when we speak, our God talk in liturgy has to be costly grace. Not cheap grace, not a glib God. A second thing seems to me very important in any proclamation from pulpits, that the God whom we worship is the Holy One of Israel. We Jews and Christians share belief in the one God. We have different ways of understanding the one God. We have this great image and metaphor of the Trinity. By saying it's a metaphor, I don't think that I am in any way diminishing it. It is our God talk. But it is the one God. And sometimes, you know, I don't know why this hasn't died, because it's so unbelievably ignorant about the scriptures. But I taught undergraduates for a long time, so I have no illusions about what people come to college knowing, particularly about the Bible, which is very little. But one of the things that somehow they've inherited along the way is that we have this God of wrath in the Old Testament and the God of love in the New Testament. That is still a caricature that is alive and well in our churches. And how you get rid of that, I don't know, except by much more positive preaching. And also, of course, by direct encounter with the text. I mean, it's very difficult to read the Hebrew Bible and come up with that post-distortion. And the third thing I started with just reading the scriptures, by which I mean reading the scriptures with, in part, a more poetic eye. This old notion that we inherited that the Old Testament is the preparation and the New Testament is the fulfillment, and you can read the lectionary that way unless you're careful, because to a certain extent the lectionary has been set up that way, one extent or another. And the person that I find especially helpful about that in connecting this with the liturgical tradition is a Lutheran laywoman by the name of Gail Ramshaw, who has a number of publications. She's very, very sensitive to that. I might add that we were classmates at Union, and I haven't seen her since then, but I always read her things, because she has a real sensitivity to this, and at the same time, to the poetic quality of liturgy. Because I don't think we should be preaching about this all the time. I think where the change has to happen is in the hymnody and in the interpretation of texts and so forth. And so, you know, how it is that we draw upon the Old Testament, the First Testament, of the Hebrew Bible, in a way in which we use the imagery in very, very rich ways, but we don't diminish its revelatory power while always doing a comparison contrast with the New Testament, in which it comes out second. So, questions, comments, sort of continue the conversation begun earlier. And then I just have one little concluding thing that I want to make right at just before 11:30. So, comments, questions, observations, arguments, refinements, embellishments, and so forth.
Just as a theologian, just to point out very briefly that yes, but ultimately I think in the context of the Holocaust, what people like Rosemary Luther have seen so well is that we're required to rethink the very claims of Christianity in its very fundament. And that I think is the larger task of Christian theology. She's tried to do that in her notion of Polybian Christology and so forth. These, we have to ask, and I find myself as a theologian asking these questions to myself continuously, what do I mean when I say, when I make the claims of realized eschatology, for example? What do I mean when I make these claims? And I think that's, I've become extremely cautious in my thinking in terms of trying to get very, very clear as to what it is we mean when we make these kinds of claims, particularly in terms of what are the effects of the claims we make in terms of the violence that they've been causing. And so I think, I just want to, as a theologian, point out that the task that you point out is, at the level of systematics, enormous. So, and is going to be, I think, the work of centuries, quite frankly.
I think the work has just begun, yes. And I think Christology is an especially important topic, and I didn't know how to get in and get out of it for
right.
my life
exactly.
in 1 hour.
Exactly. Yep.
And it seems to be, sometimes there, it seems very threatening. But I'm convinced that it is where our language breaks down, that we have perhaps so made Christ the center that we've gotten off center. And that we and maybe one of the correctives to this would be a better understanding of the process by which the church came to stake its claim on the Trinity. Because we tend to have, at least in many churches I know of, we have lost the, you know, God and the Spirit somehow in our exclusive focus on the Christ. And it seems to me that's not the solution to end all solutions, but it is very, very important. Other comments or questions?
Thinking about this in light of the forum last night, which people weren't there, was just incredible. We had a conversation afterwards about how, you know, it was interesting that not only the presenters, but people who were there, there wasn't sort of a lot of opposition to this idea in more than one way, and both that this, you know, the not that anything goes on the one hand, but also that there's more than one way. And I think one of the things that gives me hope about this is that, in fact, people hold different and somewhat conflicting ideas within their own mind. On the one hand, they have images and categories and all this shaped by a traditional sort of anti-Semitism within Christianity, I believe there is, hymns and the way we read the scripture and so on, and the kind of preaching that has gone on for centuries. But on the other hand, at least in my experience and in the Lutheran Church, and I think this is ecumenical too, that there's a, and this wouldn't maybe include, this wouldn't include fundamentalist churches, this wouldn't include mainstream churches, that there's a deep awareness of our basic kinship and being siblings with other religions among lay people. I mean, lay people are farther out on this than clergy and theologians. And so that to me is the ground on which we can work on this theologically and in terms of how we do, you know, homiletics and other things that people want, I think, in some kind of way, if they're not conscious of it, to bring these things together so that there isn't this sort of, on the one hand, you know, these hymns going around that are, you know, ransom captive Israel, and, you know, well, yeah, my brother-in-law's Jewish, and I've been to his, you know, his son's bar mitzvah, and, you know, and all this, and that's the reality of people's lives, and that they see the authenticity in the other traditions, but it doesn't connect up with, you know, the other pieces.
And I really think this is very important for the, peace of the world, ultimately. I'm not saying religion's the cause of all wars, but, you know, there's been more.
And yet, what is the most rapidly growing religious group? Well, in the United States, it's the fundamentalists.
Well, because, for many reasons, and we need some psychologists and sociologists here, they speak to something very deep that they're not getting in more liberal church traditions. And I think we have to pay attention to, I mean, in many ways, I think fundamentalists ask the right questions. Some of the right questions. I just think their answers are pretty heavy-handed and just quite wrong. But what I think is so important is that once you understand something about the religious and other, you begin to have an investment in the health of the other community. When I meet a Jew who's not practicing, I feel like I want them to be Jewish. You know, I mean, I don't want to make convert them. I want them to be who they are. But the most touching story I know about this, I work very closely with a Jewish colleague in Los Angeles, whose name is Sarah Lee. She does not make cheesecake or croissants, but she's a fabulous educator. We've worked together for about 12, 13 years now. And shortly after I moved to New York, she had come to stay with me to do some work. And she tells a story. She was on a plane going home. She says, I never talked to the person next to me, but they struck up a conversation because they were stuck in a thunderstorm. And you know how things like this happen. And it turns out that he was a non-practicing Catholic. That it's a long story, and I won't bore you with all the details, although she's a great raconteur. And I have to tell you that she grew up in Boston. She's a generation older than I, but her brothers were beaten up because they were Christ killers and so forth. She didn't sort of come to Christian-Jewish relations easily. Really something had happened in her middle age, and now we've lived together, and she's had all these other kind of experiences. And she said, much to my amazement, as we crossed the continent, I found myself telling him about Vatican II and all that was happening in the church. And I realized I wanted him to go back to church. He didn't know what had been going on. Now, if you understand, this is a Jew who grew up quite bitter, with good reasons, I might add, toward Christianity. And what her experience of interreligious dialogue has meant that she wants now Christians to be better Christians. And I really think that could have, if we could, you know, put more sparks to this, that this could really be a tremendous dynamism, better word, toward a living in a pluralistic world where we respected one another. And I think, so let me end, because it is time, with a quotation. Actually, it's taken from a, since I sometimes am a little hard on Catholic documents like papal bulls, I probably should end on a more positive note. This is a document that came out from the Commission on Religious Relations with Jews in Rome. Oh, before I do this, I didn't write the name on the board. There's a wonderful little book, Miracle of Miracles, done by the Catholic bishops on preaching in light of the Jewish-Christian issue, called God's Mercy Endures Forever. And if you can't find it, it's published out of Washington, D.C., and has some very fine suggestions. It would make an excellent, even while it's primarily for preachers, it's the kind of thing you could use with lay people for study around this issue. God's Mercy Endures Forever, Washington, D.C. If you can't find it, just email.
National Conference.
Yeah, National Conference of Catholic Bishops, that kind of thing. And I'd be happy to pass on the address. I just don't carry it with me in my head. You mentioned the sense of realized eschatology. That is, everything has been accomplished in Jesus, and, you know, basically we're just kind of waiting for the end, which is a very dangerous notion. I think this is this particular paragraph is a great counterpoint as a meditation to that. This is speaking of where we are as Jews and Christians today. And it reads, attentive to the same God who has spoken, hanging on the same word. We have to witness to one same memory and one common hope in him who is master of history. I have to do without the male imagery there. But we must also accept our responsibility to prepare the world for the coming of the Messiah by working together for social justice, respect for the rights of persons and nations, and for social and international reconciliation. To this, we are driven, Jews and Christians, by the command to love our neighbor, by a common hope for the kingdom of God, and by the great heritage of the prophets. You know, imagine, I've never seen it this way, but imagine your parish bulletin in Lent, or Advent, probably more properly, more appropriately, headed with this citation, and you know, saying to the congregation, reflect on this. So at any rate, those of you who have come this morning, and those of you who have persevered through more than one of these summer-like fairs, just simple issues in the church like this, I thank you for your attentiveness and your presence and your insights. And since I'm leaving tomorrow, I have to say sort of Godspeed to all of you. And in my experience of the church, it's a very small world. You know, many of us will meet again in some kind of way. So thank you very much.